Blog Talk Radio.
I stroll through the pictures, what I've left behind. You want again. I'm locked up in memories, they all intertwine. The memories in my mind. I know tomorrow, 'cause that dawn will come. You will never know what you've done.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to SANS Radio, Stop Child Abuse Now, radio show number 3099. SANS is the National Association of Adult Survivors of Child Abuse. And we'll begin by reading the mission statement of NASCA. We have a single purpose at NASCA: to address issues related to childhood abuse and trauma, including sexual assault, violent or physical abuse, emotional traumas, and neglect. And we do so with only two goals. One, educating the public, especially as related to helping society get over its taboo of discussing childhood sexual abuse, CSA. Presenting facts showing child abuse to be a pandemic worldwide problem that affects everyone. And two, offering hope and healing through numerous paths, providing many services to adult survivors of child abuse and information for anyone interested in the many issues involving prevention, intervention, and recovery. And on Tuesday and Thursday nights here on SANS Radio, we have a question and answer call-in discussion with a survivor professional using an open mic forum. And I'll give you the number to call in. That number is 646-595-2114. 646-595-2114. You can call in and tell a little bit about your own story, ask a question, make a comment. The show's here for you. And so tonight, our survivor professional co-host is Dr. Jaime Romo from San Diego, an educator, consultant, author, and minister who promotes prevention and healing from child sexual abuse, particularly abuse by religious authorities or in the context of religious settings. A workbook he wrote, Healing the Sexually Abused Heart, a workbook for survivors, strivers, and supporters, is an integration of various disciplines that led Jaime to become a certified traumatic incident reduction, TIR, facilitator. Jaime explains, quote, "While it is no secret that I'm a survivor of crazy abuse, it is the journey of integration, transformation, and application that is most telling about my accomplishments and the life that I celebrate," unquote. This is his website, jaimeromo.com, and that is spelled J-A-I-M-E-R-O-M-O.org. Actually.com, I'm sorry, .org. Okay, so on these Tuesday and Thursday episodes, we welcome various survivor professionals as co-hosts who assist with fielding questions and lead a variety of topics.
MacBook Pro 3, lost. Connected to MacBook Pro 3.
I'm sorry. On these episodes, we welcome various co-hosts who lead a variety of topics suggested by our call-in participants. Their trauma-informed perspectives will help them guide discussions on the issues of child abuse, trauma, and healthy human sexuality that spring from questions and topics brought to us by our listeners. Everyone's invited to engage on tonight's show. And again, the phone number to do that is area code 646-595-2114. Okay, and with that, I will introduce Dr. Jaime Romo. Hello.
Hello, can you hear me okay?
I can.
Oh, very good. Because I'm on my end, you are sounding a bit garbled. I'm not sure. So anyway, I'm glad. And I'm glad to be here. And, you know, just quick introduction of myself. While for many years I was disconnected from my own abuse, and my experience was clergy sexual abuse, and there are other layers of trauma, you know, just poverty and racism and violence in my home and a lot of things that I didn't feel safe with. It was when I was kind of at the most successful point in some terms, you know, back about 20 years ago when I was in K-12 education as administrator and then a teacher educator, and I was fairly established that my own abuse trauma surfaced. That was when the Boston clergy abuse, you know, scandal was breaking in news, and that triggered my own memories. And since then, I have been working to integrate all those life experiences. And currently, I serve in a role as a hospice chaplain, which I consider more of a spiritual companion, not particularly religious, but certainly helping people, you know, as a companion, just to sort through, you know, what do I need to let go of, and what do I really want at this point? And so that kind of leads me to a topic for tonight, if I may jump into that.
Yes,
because I deal with, you know, people as they're asking those big important questions, and you know, ultimately people want peace, and it's easy, it may be familiar, and it makes sense that we can get caught up in the things that have been grievances, you know, the things in us individually or collectively, things that happen to us or happen around us. And, you know, I was just with a patient today, and, you know, and that can really, like, we can lose our minds getting caught up in those things that are upsetting. And so I asked him, you know, so like, what brings you joy? You know, what do you want? And that opened up a whole different conversation. So this is a short reading, and it's focused on peace because, even in our activism, you know, we intending to bring justice or healing, we can sometimes be focused on the resentment, the grievance. And so anyway, here's a reading that a colleague shared with me today. And it starts with a quote by Louise Birkenau. I don't know who that is. It says, imagine that we conjure up a world that is safe for mothers and daughters. That's a huge thing, being safe. I was just with a patient, and she had a lifetime of trauma and addiction and been living, functioning, working, but living in her car. And she's a patient now. And her journey has always been about being safe. And so here's the reading. The question of violence and danger in society occupies a lot of time, breath, and printer's ink. The possibilities of peace and safety take up very little. It's usual for us to think of containing violence by greater violence, the violence of weapons, of prisons, of riot squads, and yet the teachers whose wisdom we prize above all others tells us that one cannot answer force with force, that only peace and detachment can meet violence and draw out its poisons. No sane person wants war, yet we're so locked into violent patterns of thinking that many of us believe we should prepare for it. How would we go about preparing for peace? What are the first steps we could take? What is peace, anyhow? We seem to know very little about it. A world that is safe for mothers and daughters would be safe for fathers and sons as well. So let's search our hearts to discover what we know of peace, and let us talk to one another, work together to realize that knowledge. And so this little follow-up comment is, I shall not study violence anymore. Instead, I shall discover as much as I can about peace and safety, for in my life, peace begins with me. So it does make sense to me, especially if I've looked at my own development, I would call it, from being first disconnected from the harm that came to me, or and when I connected with it, being full of rage and trying to bring about support and accountability and justice and even healing, but coming from a place of war, really. I wanted to take out those who caused harm and those who betrayed and those who covered up. And even doing it, you know, through a legal system or, you know, by pressure and, you know, shaming others. And that was toxic for me. And so over time, I think what resonates more is that I acknowledge there's a lot of work to be done, a lot of harm that needs to be stopped, a lot of prevention that needs to be put in place. But what I can do is starting with myself, find a kind of not hot anger, but call it cold anger that coexists with compassion, that allows me then to come from a different place. So activism, you know, is more of a spiritual practice. And then, you know, I know in my own experience, you know, what can I do for in my relationships is to be present and to be compassionate, you know, not shaming as I have experienced and internalized or have I done in the past, and be good to others. So, and then in the bigger picture, you know, I'm going to lead a TIR facilitator training at the end of this month. I've posted it on the NASCA site. I'll do it again. But, you know, to have others be able to find some relief, some peace in, within themselves so that they can then facilitate for others. So it's a lot of different thoughts just about, you know, what is this peace thing? What is this journey? And what are we, how can we begin?
Beautiful, thank you. What is it, and how do we begin? That's a wonderful question. I feel like I have peace in my life, and I'm not sure that I can define it. I do want to say that we have several other people on the line, and I think one of them is Victoria. Let me put them in, and we'll see who's on the line with us. Victoria,
hey, good night.
Are you there? Hello.
Good day. Can you hear
good
me?
Yes.
Yeah, this is Bob from the Whitsunday Islands and in Australia. And sorry, I didn't catch the name of the guest today. So My apologies.
That's Dr. Jaime Romo.
Good day, Jaime. How are you going, mate?
I'm well, thank you.
Yeah, and I agree with you. The host's audio is very muffled and garbled, and it's hard for me to get clarity on what she's saying. But for me, the question I pose to everybody is, if you are not creating your life, who is? And if you are not creating your life, you are a victim by definition. And this is no judgment. This is just where I've come to in my own journey. And in my own journey, healing the wounds of my childhood was the most powerful work I've ever undertaken, because I remember and I know that I was born into this realm as a magical little child where the world was full of wonder and awe, and you know, I'm tottering around and just learning to walk and the world is magical. But by the time I was 7 or 8 years old, all that magic had been beaten out of me. And for me, that's such a wound. And as far as wounding goes, looking at Western society, it's hard for me to imagine any child growing up in that society that has had all their developmental needs met. And then this thing in our society about child sexual abuse and for me, abuse is abuse is abuse. It can be physical, it can be emotional, it can be spiritual, it can be intellectual, but there are no, abuse is not a competition. And all it takes for me is to look at into the eyes of the child, and if there is a look of terror in the eyes of the child, then that is enough abuse, because what has happened there is the trust of the child to its primary caregiver has been broken. And for me, trust is like virginity, you know, like once you break it, how can you heal it? But fortunately, with the help of John Bradshaw, back in about 1990, I went back and I knew I couldn't change the past, but I had a feeling that I could heal the past. And so I went back and I healed the wounds of my childhood. And that, my friend, was the most powerful work I've ever done. And what I've come to realize is, in our Western society, what is killing people more than anything is their obedience to programming. They are living in head space, not heart space. And it took me 20 years to remove 40 years of programming. Now, I am on a personal mission to eradicate suicide. And every 40 seconds, somebody dies because of depression. And they do not have to. And I am living proof of that. Because there is no such thing as mental illness for me. Depression is just a rite of passage. And it's just my body. When I had my first panic attack, that was my body saying to me, whack, Bob, wake up. Go and find your truth and live your truth and walk your talk. And so that's where I am. And sometimes I'm happy and sometimes I'm sad. You know, if I was happy all the time, how would I know? So sometimes I'm happy and sometimes I'm sad, but I'm always content, because I bet my life on trusting my inner intuition. And that's just where I am. And I'll finish quickly with, my life is governed by two principles, and I seem to have this knack of reducing everything to a really simple common denominator. And the first principle for me is the KISS principle, which for me is keep it simple, sovereign. I know I've changed it, but then I know that the words I use create my reality. So I create spells. And then the second principle is something I coined about 12 years ago, which is the SUE principle, S-U-E. For me, we are all sovereign, unique, and equal. And everything else flows from that. So for me, there is no argument. Everyone holds a piece of the puzzle. And so all I say is, find your truth, celebrate your differences, because your beautiful differences is what makes you beautifully unique. And I'll shut up because I could go on for hours on this topic. All I know is I'm a simple bloke. I'm a simple bloke, and I spent 20 years addicted to antidepressants, and I was locked in the trap of the intellect trying to think my way out. But it wasn't until I could silence my mind and listen to my heart that I found my own solutions. And, and I'm just here to add my little spice to this beautiful cake that we are all creating. Okay, I'll shut up now. Honest.
I want to hear from everybody, and I just also wanted just to say how so much of what you said really resonates, you know, with that question. You know, is beautiful. Like, if we're not creating our life, what was it? Who is? You know, if we're not the authors.
Yeah. Simple.
But just to say, you know, that we have these. It is. That we have had things happen to us that have maybe given us the impression that we're not sovereign, right? And that disconnect us. I appreciate, you know, there's no pain Olympics, really. I mean, even though I've done that in the past, you know, like my abuse, you think you've been abused, you think you've had trauma. That makes sense, coming from a victim place and then a survivor place. I think it's not linear, but I do think there are differences in how we take our experience up, and so that when we are able to, you talked about Bradshaw, you know, healing our past, you know, become more whole, be able to face what has happened to us, be able to face what we've internalized. And you talk about, you know, that we're, I wrote it down, but that we're, you know, following maybe what others have put on us, when we're able to embrace and become with compassion, and I would say even, you know, some grief work, that it allows us then to come from a different place, to realize that we are sovereign, and with that, you know, that we're no better or no less than anyone, and that we are unique. I love so many of the things that you've brought up, and you know, I think it is in doing our own reconnecting that we can learn to trust ourselves, and from that place we figure out little by little maybe how to have an open heart and to trust others. But I just really appreciate, you know, the energy, the vision of that we're not the sum total of our wounds, right? You know, there's so much more, and that those can be powerful resources as we go forward.
Well, what I've come to realize, my friend, is that in Western society, we're all victims of victims, and if you don't hand it back, you pass it on. And during my childhood, my mum was randomly violent. She was like, you know, it's like living next to a volcano. And I got to this place where in the early 90s, doing Bradshaw work. God, I hate you, Mum. You know, why are you always beating me? You know, but you got to love your mum because you've only got one mum, and it was that dichotomy that was tearing my soul apart. And so, and this is probably the hardest thing I ever did, I just sat down and wrote a letter to Mum saying, "Dear Mum, just telling you my story about how I felt as a child growing up in our family. And, you know, I thought it was going to be a couple of pages, but it ended up being as thick as War and Peace. But I just wrote, Mum, I hated it when you beat me with a carpet sweeper. I hated it when you dangled me by my wrist and beat me with the frying pan. And, you know, I just splits it all out in this letter that I was actually writing. And then, as it says, that's my dog in the background. And the hardest thing I ever did was actually, I finished the letter and said, "Dear Mum, this is just my story. Please tell me your story." And then I actually posted that letter to her. And that's probably one of the hardest things I've ever done. I'm in Australia. She's back in England. And so eventually I got a letter back from Mum saying, "Oh, Bobby, you must think I'm the first mother in the whole world. But I was only doing my very best." And so I wrote back and said, "Mum, this is not about blame. Please, Mum, tell me your story." And so she eventually wrote back, and she was born in Germany in 1924 between the wars. Her dad was an alcoholic, her mum was a control freak. Her cousins were in the SS or they were shot. And then I realized by her sharing her story that she had a really violent childhood too. And that's when the light bulb went off and I realized that, yes, my mum was doing the very best that she could, but all that she could do was dump on me what got dumped on her. And with that realization, I could move from that place of anger through understanding back to love. And then a few days later, I phoned my mum in the UK and she was back in hospital with a second bout of bowel cancer. And and that was the first time we actually spoke as mother and son, as two equals. And, you know, tears are streaked down our faces. And then the following day she died, and that was such a beautiful closure. But consequent to that, about 5 years later, I contacted my mum through a spiritual medium in the beyond, and the message, and I knew the medium was Fair Dinkum because she shared stuff that only mum and I knew. So and what the dialogue that I got from mum was, Bobby, thank you so much for writing that letter, because I am now going and doing the same work with my own parents in the beyond. My friend blew me away.
Beautiful, beautiful. Again, and I think, Annie, you may have other people on the line, but it just, again, like, I start off with that quote about peace, you know, what would the world be if we would be safe for women and children? And I think in your story, you made it safe for her to tell her story. And I forget where it is, but this quote about, if we don't tell our story, we suffocate. So for you to write your story, for you to not put it out, you know, to be right, but just to tell your story and give her that space was tremendously healing, you know, and healing intergenerationally, because we've inherited, as you pointed out, you know, and then we just pass on unless we do something different. So thank you. That's awesome.
Yeah, well, where I'm coming from.
Yes, thank you, Bob.
I'll just finish with this, and my name is Bob, not Paul. I'll just finish with this. Going back to my Sioux principle, we're all sovereign, unique, and equal. And all I can say is that everyone holds a piece of the puzzle, and that simply by sharing our stories, we help to heal each other.
I love that.
Thanks, bro.
You've distilled a lot. Yeah.
That's my skill.
And I just want to say, you know, yeah. But you know, here we go across continents, right? We're hearing, you know, resonant stories, right? Resonant learning, being more whole. It's, I think that is what is underlying all of us, right? We are able to connect and to join and to be more whole. So I thank you for sharing your story.
No worries, mate.
Heine, this is Annie. Can you hear me all right?
Yeah.
I'm glad. I don't know what was wrong earlier, but here I am. And we do have two people on the line whose mics don't seem to be working. I want those people to know that there seems to be something wrong with the dashboard. It's not letting the phone number open. If that makes sense. So let's see. Let me ask, is there someone on the line who would like to ask a question of Dr. Romo?
Question or comment, yeah.
No.
Thank you.
We'll hope that these other two phone numbers will open up. I can't tell what's wrong with them. They just keep going in circles. So, Dr. Romer, I'll turn it back over to you.
Well, you sound much clearer now, so whatever you've done on your end is really beneficial. And
thank you.
Yeah. For me, in my final analysis, all that I have is my story. That's all I can ever own. You know, my personal life experience, my witness testimony, which is why I never give advice, because for me, unsolicited advice is abuse, because we're all equal. And I'm here to live my life my way, not your way. So all I have is my story. And that's why my life is so simple. You know, because all we got to do is share our stories. We don't need psychiatrists or psychologists or petrochemical medications. All we need to do is sit around the campfire and share our truth in heart space.
Yeah. So, Bob, if I could kind of join again and add, years ago, you said, you know, we don't need psychologists, we don't need medications. Years ago, I was in the jungles of southern Mexico in Chiapas, and there's, you know, very little electricity, let alone like no Western, you know, psychology and psychologists and that kind of stuff. But people would go, well, one, people lived in this community. They belonged, right? And I think that is what brings healing. But in the plaza, in the center of town, you know, someone would walk and stop at a stand and kind of share what was going on in their life and what problems, and then they would go to another and be able to share, and then to another. It was just as a matter of, you know, talking through with their community, sharing their story and belonging. There's an expression that the opposite of addiction is connection, and I mentioned that with the idea of your mission to help end suicide, because, you know, the more connected we are, the less we are likely to use outside things to kind of feel connected or to completely, you know, disconnect. So I really appreciate the sharing stories, belonging, and connection.
Well, for me, my friend, there is no out there. When I first had my first panic attack in 1984, I've got an amazing intellect, I spent probably 20 years trying to think my way out of depression. I was living in headspace, and now I moved house to heart space, and I found all, and I learned how to silence my mind so that I could clear, listen and hear my heart. And living in heart space, you know, for me, the mind is just a tool that I use when I choose, for I'm so much more than my mind. And it was that realization that allowed me to take the pain of depression that I was experiencing, and it is a very real pain, use that as the motive force to go within and find my own truth. And so at that time I started questioning everything that I previously had held as truth. You know, what my parents taught me, what the mainstream media taught me, what the education or indoctrination system was telling me. And I realized it was all bullshit. And so when I started questioning everything and began the journey, and I set that as my life purpose, to simply find my own truth. But by questioning everything, I did find my own truth. And how do I know what is my truth? Whatever resonates with my heart. And I go back to the KISS principle. Keep it simple, sovereign. Because, you know, the mind is always looking for answers, but your heart already knows.
Hi, this is Victoria. Can you hear me?
Hello?
Is my mic open now?
Yes, it is.
Oh, good. Hi, Jamie. I'm really sorry. I'm the other host here. And we just couldn't get my mic to connect at all. So I tried to talk a few times, and I've been messaging Annie, and she keeps messing me back. The mic keeps spinning, you know. I'm really glad that you're here with us. And I've read a little bit of your bio. I came in late because my cab from my therapist didn't come in on time, so I missed a lot of what you were talking about, but I want to make sure that, you know, you're getting in what you want to say. And if you've got, I don't know if you've got a website or got an organization. I couldn't even get in because my computer just got sent in yesterday. So I'm kind of running on a tail here, on a tail feather. But I'm glad that I finally got my mic working and that I get to talk to you. And, you know, you said that we have a lot of differences, but, you know, the abuse and stuff. And I always try to tell people, let's look at our commonalities rather than our differences, because we have so much in common, especially our feelings, you know. Like I can say I'm angry and people know what I mean. They know anger, you know, or I was really sad about the situation in my life. People, you know, can feel my feelings, maybe not feel them exactly, but, you know, can relate to what sad is. And so I always say, let's look at what we have in common rather than we have different.
Feelings are healings, eh? The feeling you swallow today come back and choke you, in my experience.
Yeah. I would echo that, the idea that what we don't metabolize, you know, what we don't transform, we transmit, right? Yeah, and that, and also though, I mean, for me, there was a shift from, you know, I feel angry to, and at the time I was angry, right? It's like you have to feel angry and be angry, right? You can respond and appreciate, you know, again, Bob, talking about the heart, you know, connecting, to our heart is even, physiologically, you know, the heart is what sends the hormones through the body to either be, you know, panicked or to be soothed.
and our mind is following really the heart. So feelings are healing, and at the same time they can be totally messy, because I know for me, going from suppression and depression, the next step up was anger, and I had to let things out, you know, and, mm-hmm. and to be able to continue to be more whole and wholehearted.
So I read a little bit about your bio, and so you're a survivor of a clergy abuse?
Yes.
Is that right? Okay, I just wanted to make sure.
Yes.
I was reading the right bio. But my biological father was very involved in the church, and I didn't grow up with him, but he would kept coming back to my life, and I didn't know to be afraid of him because I had developed multiple personality disorder. And I was afraid of him, but I didn't really know why, so I just kind of told myself I was crazy, you know, and then I'd be back in his grips again. But, you know, he could quote the Bible back and forth, and was teaching Sunday school for adults and taking kids on camping trips, and the family thought he was awesome, and 10th highest computer performer in the nation, and, you know, just all these wonderful things. The community thought he was awesome, and, you know, and yet he used all that intelligence and all those religious words and everything else to twist around to do the, you know, abuse that he did to me. And not a lot of people understand the spiritual and religious abuse, and there's just words that just like trigger me that I heard from him, you know, religious types of things. And I was wondering if you had that sort of a reaction or response, or I asked the beginning of what you were talking about. So if you could share a little bit more of your story with us, because you are our special guest, and we want to make sure that you get in what you came here to talk about. Thank you.
Thanks. And well, I missed your name. I'm sorry.
Sorry. For me, all
my
religion.
My name is Victoria Kelly, and we're going to let Jamie talk
to
you.
Victoria.
How are you, darling?
I'm here.
Yes, you are.
Well, I'll come in. I'm going to come in quickly, and then I'll get out of the way.
For me, all religions are about control. And I love this little one because I've got a wicked sense of humor. For me...
Okay, let's let Jamie talk because I asked him the question.
Yeah, just give me a minute and then I'll shut up for good. Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay, for me, I love this one. Religion is for those folks that are afraid of going to hell. And spirituality is for those folks that have already been there. And Jesus, mate, I have been there. With that note, I will shut up and just let the flow go. Thanks so much for your time and attention. Bye for now.
Yeah.
I didn't mean to shut you off.
Don't go away.
No, don't go away, please. We appreciate your feedback and your support here, so don't leave. I just was asking Jamie because I didn't hear any of his story. That's all. That wasn't nothing against you. You've given a lot of really positive information on here, and I appreciate that you're here. So don't leave.
Echo that, and just I love that. I think there is clearly religious abuse, and there's a history of that being a mechanism for control. Religio. The Latin means to bind together, and so I think there is some in developmentally there's some use to give people like some guidelines, but certainly controlling behavior and information and thoughts and emotion is abuse. In fact, that's the kind of definition of cults. But I think Bob, you mentioned earlier, there's all kinds of abuse. I mean, we can't say one is worse in that, you know, each person may have more resilience. Certainly for me, the experience of religious authority, sexual abuse was profound, because I came from a family that had this blind faith, you know, in church, and those who represented God were our hope. And so there was, besides the you know, the breaking of boundaries and trust and internalized shame and all that. There was, you know, like there was this, God had a hand in this. And so just to, you know, touch on your question about, you know, certain words and things may be triggering, of course, you know, and I think people, ideally, we all are home and free wherever we are, you know, knowing that some places have associations and can be triggered by, you know, that the idea of them, whether it's a church or a person, authority figures. And I think it is an ongoing process to, you know, to recognize, okay, I'm not going to avoid being in the world. I'm not going to avoid certain even places, ideally. You know, but that may be a healing step for a while, is to step back. You know, ultimately, I mean, doesn't this religion represent authority? And Bob, to link to what you were saying, you know, we are sovereign. You know, so we need to find ways to take up our own authority and rightfully question, you know, question whether it's an educational system or a religious system, a political system, you know, take up our own authenticity and authority. And I think in part the dangerous and or difficult part of that can be that we can also do harm. Like we can also, without realizing it, have a kind of influence over others that without even realizing it. I think it's just an ongoing learning and one of humility as well as in a paradoxical way, one of really embracing our, as you said, sovereignty. But I do appreciate that there is this painful process sometimes of letting go of, for whatever reason, you know, others' teachings or others' practices or rituals or religions. Not even those who, that have been overtly abusive, because there are, you know, ritual abuse. There are people who are under the umbrella of religion who do physical and emotional and spiritual harm, you know, real overt. And while that may seem extreme, I think, you know, we are right to be skeptical and to learn to find that connection in ourselves, that authority in ourselves, but to hold that gently.
Yeah, my grandma wanted me to, I got baptized so I didn't go to hell, so she sent me to catechism, right, because she's Catholic. And they didn't like me there. They didn't like me there because I kept asking questions. And apparently, when you're going to catechism, you just ask questions. I found that out major quick. And
yeah,
I go to AA. I've got 36 years sober. And I have to get out and leave before the last prayer, and I can't even say it because a lot of the words, even the beginning and the name of the prayer, still triggers me. And I've been in therapy since I was 21. I escaped from my biological father when I was 21. I couldn't put three words together. Couldn't look nobody in the eye and I shook all the time. And I was suicidal and I hated myself. And, you know, it was really helpful for me. I needed to be on medication and I still need to be on medication. And the thing about NASCA is that we don't advocate for any particular type of healing. We're all here on our own healing journey. But the great thing is that we get to share the different, you know, ways that we've come to where we are in our journey. That's what I think is, you know, really important to have special guests on so we can hear different ways that people have, you know, survived first off and, you know, and then ended up, you know, being able to do something to let other people and help other people. Not everybody wants to be a speaker, write a book, whatever. But, you know, just the fact that people are willing to come on and tell their story, you don't know that maybe one sentence you say might be something that somebody didn't even have the words, you know, to put the words to what the abuse was, you know. And so I'm really glad that you came on. And then if you would tell us, you know, like what was the turning point for you that you think that, you know, that your journey in your healing started?
Wow. Well, and invite others to speak up. But I mean, I think, Bob, you mentioned earlier, you know, pain, anxiety attacks. I mean, there are things that our bodies and our emotions scream out to us that are saying we need attention. Right? And so, you know, for me, when I was having, you know, these flashbacks and emotionally I was just enraged, you know, that was my body and my heart saying, you know, this needs attention. And so I did a lot of things with that energy as an advocate for others and leading groups and leading press conferences and protesting against, you know, the diocese and on and on. And I thought I did other things with that energy that were maybe more constructive. You know, I was a teacher. I was helping people to take up their voice and help others. But, you know, on a more like when I was at the lowest, when I had PTSD, I went to a psychiatrist and I was like others, I would never, ever, you know, take medication. But I did that, I think, for about a year as part of just getting stability. I mean, I did a lot of different things, whether they were sweat lodges or group therapy or individual therapy. And I think a turning point was being guided through a process to acknowledge the wounds, to hear more and to realize, you know, what I had experienced of abandonment and abuse and shame that I had internalized. So I was abandoning myself and abusive to myself and then carrying shame regardless of how accomplished I might be. And then with that, having a sense of compassion and taking responsibility, you know, mm-hmm. then seeing the impact I had on others and, you know, and making amends to some degree. And so that was a significant turning point, is being able to, mm-hmm. you know, stop some of the activities outward and be present, you know, and be good to yeah. myself and to acknowledge and, you know, the opposite.
Yeah, a big point for me was realizing that that I do have control over my life. Now, sometimes I still have to remind myself that, you know, because I feel like that little child that has no choices, and I kind of dig myself into my own corner, you know, or fall down the rabbit hole because I get into that thinking. Because it just was always there, you know. I was sexually abused before I was a year old, and I never had that wonder of life, and you know, oh, everything's going great, and then some tragedy happened. It just tragedy was just always there, and you know, it. I had so much self hate, and when mm-hmm. I finally realized that, you know, my healing was in my hands, you know, and that I could find ways and search out resources and people and everything else. People came into my lives. It wasn't the easiest way. I ended up, you know, in a psych ward and them saying, hey, you know, and they put me on antidepressants. He says, you've been depressed all your life. And it was like watching a black and white TV and somebody just, you not even knowing, bringing in a color TV and turning it on. You know, mm-hmm. it was a whole different world. Didn't even know that world existed. And I have a world today. I'm going to turn 61 at the end of the month. My son just got me a house. It's been just a few days over a year ago. And I told my son when I got this place, I said, I feel better physically, spiritually, emotionally. I have in my whole entire life. And he says, really, Mom? Why is that? You know, and I says, well, because I have stability now. I said, that is something mm-hmm. I never had my whole life, is stability. You know, I don't have to worry. If I'd have got kicked out of the last place, which they tried to do over my service animal, that'd have been my 20th time homeless. I haven't had no stability, you know. And I did take a lot of, you know, I literally had to take my power back because it was stolen mm-hmm. from me. I really believe that God put me on this earth to sexually satisfy men. That was the only, that's what I believed. For years and years and years and years, you know, because that's just what kept happening to me.
Yeah, I mean, I hear some intersection. I don't know, Bob, if you're still on the line, but I mean, with that idea of, you know, yeah, becoming our own authors, becoming sovereign.
Right. Yep. Yeah, matter of fact, I changed that KISS as well. Some people say keep it simple, stupid, which I absolutely hate. So I changed it mm-hmm. to keep it simple, sweetheart.
mm-hmm.
And I always correct people when they mm-hmm. say it the other way. But I've got 36 years sober from drugs and alcohol, so I do speaking on that as well as child abuse and domestic violence, and I'm also a survivor of systems of prostitution. So I've been speaking on, you know, a lot of issues for many years since 1986, but I didn't start talking about my child abuse till a little over 10 years ago when I talked to Bill, because I had so much shame around not getting away, not escaping until I was 21 years old. You know, people seem to think, I guess, that at the magic age of 18, all this information just drops on you and you should know it all. And I didn't know it all at 21 either. So I just figured I must have been standing in the wrong place, you know, or something. You know, I wasn't quite sure what I did wrong, you know, because people acted like I should have known at that point that, you know, I could have got help and that, you know, that there were ways out, and I was totally trapped. He had pornography of me. He was going to show it to everybody. He was going to take me to Louisiana and marry me and raise my daughter as our child. I mean, it just, you know, kept getting worse and worse and worse to where the point I was going to kill myself and my daughter and not leave a note, because I was in so much shame. I didn't want nobody to know what he had done to me. I'd rather people think I was a bad mom than let those secrets.
Yeah. Shame is toxic, and it's one of those things that I think happens when things happen to us and we internalize some and we interpret very young, you know, that if the authority is right and they're doing this, I must be, there's something wrong with me. You know, and that shame is, something wrong with me. And that's, it's a deep,
I can feel the word guilt and shame too, you know, and I found out that guilt is something, you know, that you do, like I stole something from the store, so I feel guilty.
Mm-hmm.
And shame is, you know, that's bad or whatever. But shame is, I am bad, like to the literal core of me. People would say, well, good things happen to good people, bad things happen to bad people. And I thought, well, I must have been a horrible baby. Or in my past life, as people would say, you know, you must have done some really bad things. And that's why, you know, when you were a child, you were sexually abused. And when you were an infant, sexually abused and all that, you know. And so, yeah, you get all these, you know, helpful advice from people. That's not that helpful. And so, like you said, defining, you know, defining for yourself who you are is just so important.
Yeah. And again, Bob, I don't know if you're still on the line, but the idea of questioning, even questioning ourselves. There's a simple two-part process that sometimes run with folks, and it's the idea of, like, get the idea that maybe you're good. Get the idea that at your core and all throughout, you are good. And Bob, you know, again, start off with, like, we're this wondrous child. Others might say we're a child of God, but however it is, get the idea that at your core, you're really good. And just, you know, sit with that idea and like, let it, I do think that. Or maybe there's some doubt there, but I still think, you know, just, again, let that percolate. And then flip it. And now get the idea that you're really not good. And honestly, take inventory. Wow, is there a part of me that really thinks that? Or no, actually, that's a crappy thing. That's a lie. And, you know, just kind of let that percolate. And then flip it back. Get the idea that you're essentially good. You are essentially sovereign. You're essentially a gift, you know, however you want to frame it. And again, clarify. So nobody else has to put, you know, give you advice. And it becomes like really connected to our deeper self. And I think that's a part of processing, you know, but to question ourselves and to really get clear so that we're not just, you know, thinking of ourselves in a certain way, but we're feeling it, we're connected to it. And again, that idea of the correlation between connection and all kinds of problems, you know, like if we're not connected, we're more likely to get into self-medicating or behaviors that, you know, somehow are self-destructive.
I'm in the program, you know, and part of that is taking an inventory. So I explain it to people this way. I worked in a store you know, and you've got all the stuff in the store and you go through everything and you go, no, I don't like, you know, that's out of date or that's, you know, that's just bad. I don't like that. Get that out of there. But you got to replace it with something, you know, that part on that shelf is empty, you know. So what positive can I replace it with? Because I don't, you know, there are things that I'm still working in and will be till the last breath, you know, that will just come to be the, wow, I shouldn't have said that, you know, just, I can't. Because when I was, if I'm good or bad, it was like black and white, you know. I've done things wrong in my life. I've done things great in my life. But ultimately, I've come to realize that I am a good person. I have a good heart. And I'm going to tell myself good things about myself. Yeah, I've made mistakes, you know, but I only did what I did with the information I had at the time. And I got bad information and outright lied to, you know. And so I don't have regrets. I just go, today is, in this moment actually, is a new moment. And I'm going forward from right now, you know, I'm just going to keep doing the next right thing. And if I make a mistake and I say something I shouldn't have said that, you know, hurts somebody's feelings, I'll apologize as soon as I can. You know, if I have good intent and a good heart and I'm doing my best, that's all I can do, you know. Your best is all you can do. And
yeah.
I stopped beating myself up.
Yeah, there's a, you know, that movie, The Love Guru, it's a comedy with Mike Myers years ago. It kind of is making fun of Deepak Chopra, who actually played a little cameo in the movie. You know, the character Mike Myers plays has these books, and one of them is titled, like, Stop Hitting Yourself. Why are you still hitting yourself? I mean, it's the title of the book, and it's, we continue to do that. I wanted to ask, because I don't know who else is on the line, if there's anybody else who wants to join.
Annie, are you still there?
I am here. It's just Jaime, Victoria, and Annie right now. There is no one else on the line right now.
Okay, would you like to join in our conversation here?
Well, sure. I don't have anything specific, so I'll let you continue.
Okay. Well, you know, this idea of change, you know, of like letting go of the layers of negative, you know, that we've inherited. There's that image of Michelangelo would talk about, you know, when he was sculpting, you know, like, how did you do this? And he said something like, you know, I just take away what is not what is the image or the, you know, what that marble wants to be, you know. And there's something about that one that it takes work. It's not a small, simple task to chip away parts of ourselves. To really change some behaviors or let go of things that are not part of this deeper self of that is good, and that has, you know, a purpose, you know, that has, you know, something that to do, I guess it's different for each person how we discern that, but I think you said something like, you know, like, God, you know, has given or shown you some things, and, you know, for others, it may be just a sense of noticing things that happen that are beyond our control, simple things, ordinary things, but that idea of changing behaviors, that's a difficult thing.
It is. It doesn't happen overnight. That's for sure. You know, there was a lot of behaviors I certainly wanted to change, but I didn't know how to do it, you know, and I did have to go to people that I admired and ask questions. I had a sponsor for 33 years, you know, and I asked all kinds of stuff. Like, I was sober for, my daughter was 4 when I got sober. So it was kind of on her 8th birthday, and I started having memories of my 8th birthday. Now I've been sober, you know, a while. But I called my sponsor and I was just dumbfounded, and I said, how do you have an 8-year-old's birthday party without booze? And I was serious. Mm. I had not a freaking clue, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had to ask people, what can I do for her birthday? I didn't necessarily have to go into my past and say how bad my eighth birthday was. But just, hey, you got any ideas for what to do for my daughter for her eighth birthday? You know?
Mm-hmm.
And nobody brought up those, you know. Interesting. Mm-hmm. You know? But yeah, it was just, you know, trying to find out different ways of doing things. And also, okay, I went and did this, and that made me feel good, you know? Oh, that must be a good thing to do because it made me feel good, you know? Or, boy, I wonder if that would make me happy, trying it out. No, that didn't make me happy going skiing and not knowing how to stop. No, that didn't make me happy at all.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know? But yeah. I just got back from Disneyland, and I went to California. My son gave me a trip to California. I went to Disneyland and Universal Studios, and we got to go out and eat. And Bill Murray, the founder of NASCAR, I got to go out and see him. He was, you know, had him over to the house that my son rented for this Airbnb, whatever you call it, really big house. Mm. And just, it was just fantastic, you know, and I just enjoyed myself so much. And, you know, I didn't have a relationship with my kids at all. When they were younger, I put them in permanent foster care because I wasn't the mom I wanted to be, and I wasn't the mom they deserved, and I knew that.
Mm.
And I put them, it was the hardest thing I ever did, but it was the best thing I ever did, you know, because neither one of them would have even graduated from high school. Because of my mental health, I couldn't get stability. I couldn't, you know, I didn't know the psych ward. When I was home, I wasn't really there, you know, and I knew I wasn't giving them the life they deserved, you know. And even after I started getting better, and people say, oh, are you going to get your kids now? I said, my kids are doing just great. They have stability. Doing great in school. I'm not going to rip that all away. Don't you want to be a mom? I mean, what's wrong with you? And, you know, I just knew in my heart that it didn't matter what people around me thought. I knew in my heart I was doing the right thing. And my kids turned out amazing. They are amazing, happy, functioning. I watch my daughter with my grandchild, and tears come to my eyes of what a loving mother she is. She's like the best mother I know. She's just there for her child no matter what anybody, you know, I mean, she's just always there for her child, and she's a healthy person. She takes care of herself and married and, you know, has a great job and has a lot of friends and helps people in the program because she's also in the program, had issues with drugs, you know, but she's got 17 years sober. She became a dual dependency counselor. And now she's working for some kind of a computer thing with my son. And you know, my kids wouldn't be, my son would be flipping hamburgers, if that, you know, because he was in a special school for kids that were, had ADHD and behavior problems and everything else. And that foster home got him mainstream back in school. He ended up getting college scholarship because it's great, so good, you know, and it just, you know, but it just didn't happen overnight, our relationship. It took a lot to us getting back in each other's lives and putting a lot of effort into it, you know. And everyone's like, oh, it's so wonderful your kids did that for you and wish I had kids like that. Well, it didn't just happen overnight. We were very estranged, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
but I wanted it and they wanted it. Yeah, you got to work in.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, in the work that the facilitation I do and the training that I'm going to lead at the end of the month, traumatic incident reduction, it works. It's very powerful and efficient and effective, but it works with three basic things. And I think, you know, those are part of your story. It's one, you have to want it. You have to have some motivation that you want those relationships to be better. You want your life to be better. The second is that we're willing to feel the discomfort. We're willing to sit through the discomfort of telling our story, of reconnecting with the things that we avoided, you know, in the moment, to, in a sense, relive sometimes those deeply wounding experiences, and knowing that by sitting through it, that we actually have huge difference, you know, different perspective, and that we, at a visceral level, have the triggers are already released or untangled.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the third is that, you know, in the process, you're not under the influence of something. So you have to have some kind of, you know, clear mind. I really, really appreciate, one, all the work, you know, that it takes, and also what you mentioned, needing to ask other people, you know, how do you have an 8-year-old birthday party without alcohol? I think that's points to the reality of the, and I think Bob mentioned earlier, like, we're all like these different pieces of this bigger story, and we can learn from each other, and sometimes we have to ask from others' perspective things that we can't see or don't know. You know, there's this show on Netflix that I've come to really like called The Amazing Attorney Wu, and it's this story of a lawyer who's has autism, and you know, she's asking people like how to socialize, you know, asking, kind of trying to figure out what's normal, mm-hmm. or what's healthy. And I was hearing a little bit of that analogy, like, you know, we have to sometimes question ourselves, like, is this a healthy thing? I mean, we don't often always automatically know what's safe or what's healthy. We may learn it, and then some of that is, as you've done, asking others. And
I started a parenting class, you know, and I was living with my grandmother at the time because I had escaped from her father, who shook her violently, and I got away from him. And anyway, you know, she says, why are you going to those parenting classes? I said, because I want to be a better parent. She goes, well, I never took parenting classes, and you turned out just fine. And I thought to myself, yeah, fine, effed up, insecure, neurotic, and emotional, fine. I mean, it's in and out of safe work, you know, and I couldn't barely function. And, I was fine, right? You know, I couldn't hold down a job, nothing. And I just, you know, pushed through that feeling of inadequacy and just said, you know, there are books out there. There's people out there. I can ask questions. That's why I still go to a psychiatrist and a therapist, because I still have questions on how it can make my life better and how I can change, you know, because I still got some old beliefs, and, you know, I might think I kicked it, you know. And I tell you what, these both times keep coming back. People go, well, you got 36 years sober. I bet you never think about using. I'll tell you one time, a lot of times I think about using is when I go to get new services or get help, and they say, you are alcoholic or you are alcoholic and drug addict. And I'll say, yeah. And they'll say, what's your drug of choice? And I'll say, well, anything anybody would get me, he was, you know. And they keep continuing to insist that I give them a drug of choice or whatever I could get, you know. And because they have a box to check off. And they won't let me just say what my reality is. So by the time they push me 20 minutes to tell them my drug of choice, all I can think of is, what would I like to use right now? You know, that's my drug. Yeah. So all of them are different. None of them are the same. You know, and you know, we don't fit in these little boxes. We just don't, you know. And, you know, then they talked about character defects, and that just really hurt me. It hurt me bad. Mm. And so I switched that to coping mechanisms, because that's how I survived. I want to survive by the end of those coping mechanisms. You know, I lied because I got in trouble for telling the truth. You know, I made up stuff because I didn't want nobody to know what I was really going through. Well, I could say I was a bad person and a liar and a this and that, but you know what? There were reasons behind that. There were reasons, you know, I'm an alcoholic and a drug addict, but alcohol and drugs are not my problem. And I'm sure people are wondering, well, what the hell you stand out there for? You know, and then I'll go into, you know, every time I stopped drinking or using, I started remembering my abuse, and I went, no wonder why I drink, or no wonder why I do drugs, and I'd be back on a rampage again. Fortunately, I had somebody who saw me guzzling out of a bottle that said, you know, Victoria, you think you might be an alcoholic? He said, oh, yeah, I am an alcoholic, but I'm one of those alcoholics that can't be helped. She said, oh, what kind of alcoholic is that? She became my sponsor, and I told her for 33 years what kind of alcoholic that was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you said a lot, and I guess one of the things I want to highlight that maybe connects a few of those is that idea of coping, you know, that you said you lied because telling the truth got you in trouble, you know, and like we do things to cope. We do things actually to get away from what may be dangerous, you know, unsafe and so on. And that's, you know, why people do all kinds of things, you know, like substances or self-destructive behaviors or avoiding things or, you know, fight and flight. I mean, those are coping mechanisms that can eventually kind of snowball. Right? And so the ACE study 25 years ago with Vince Folletti that, you know, I think more and more people really need to just understand and that, Folletti even says, you know, addictions are basically the natural consequence of these kind of coping mechanisms that have gone unaddressed, you know, and they're coping because of something, not just for their own sake. And there's another kind of coping, which is denial. You know, when you mentioned your mom saying, well, look at you, turned out fine.
That was
you know,
my grandmother.
Oh, your grandmother. Yeah. I mean, we have limited maybe ability to really see the impact, you know, of our lives on others. You know, Bob mentioned earlier how, you know, he realized his mom had this history of trauma, you know, and she passed along what she had. You know, my dad was a violent alcoholic, and on his deathbed, the best he could do, you know, because he put our lives in danger often, and we lived in an unpredictable, dangerous home, especially when he drank. And you know, on his deathbed, he said to me and my brothers, you know, I don't know if you remember when I drank. We like nearly fell out of our chairs. I'm like, you nearly killed us on a regular basis when you drank.
Right.
How could you think we don't remember? But that was his coping mechanism was, you know, to suppress and to deny and to disconnect. And, his drinking was a culmination of all kinds of horrible, you know, trauma that he didn't have in childhood. So just this idea of coping to me is really, really important that it may not be good and healthy and may be self-destructive. And that's why I went back to, you know, for people to heal and, you know, we need to be able to face fully our experiences. And, you know, I've been thinking about, you know, some people who I think are they're maybe extraordinary in that their trauma, their abuse was so extreme. But essentially they have faced so much their past that they're in a place of gratitude. And, you know, not saying that I would wish other people to have that kind of abuse, but to say, you know, I am whole. I am, I've learned and I'm an agent of healing. I have resources now that wouldn't have happened, you know, had I not faced all these things and transformed them. So,
well, that's why a lot of us say we're grateful alcoholics because, you know, I wouldn't have met the people that I have met that I've either been helped by or be able to help. If it wasn't for me being in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous or Al-Anon, or I went to a group of people that disassociated, and one of the conditions of being in that group was you couldn't be on drugs or alcohol. And that, because that group was helping me, at that point, I really, really had a strong urge to use, that kept me from not using because I didn't want to lose the group. You know, I didn't want to lose the support I had there. And in the same way with AA, it had helped me in the same way, you know. And but I was wondering, you mentioned the ACEs, and I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about what that is, because we might have some listeners. I know a lot of people know what it is, but we might have some listeners that this is the first time they've ever heard that word. Explain a little bit.
Yeah, and and many, many people have not. And so, you know, Vince Felitti is a physician with Kaiser Permanente. I've lost track of him, but 25 years ago, he was part of a weight reduction program. So people who are obese, morbidly obese, you'd come in and, you know, whatever the program was, they would lose a lot of weight. And then at some point, you found that some people would leave. They didn't finish the program. But then when they came back, they would be at that dangerous weight again. And you know, he was asking the intake question with one person, and he added a question, something like, you know, well, when did your eating habits change? Like, or when did they begin like this? And the person said something like, when I was 7 and my stepfather started, you know, molesting me, sexually abusing me. And he asked this new question, and he ruined his protocol because they were, you know, making a study out of how effective the program was. So they came up with, you know, many questions about adverse childhood experiences, things that happened to us, things that happened around us, and things that should have happened. So, you know, physical, emotional, sexual abuse that happens to us, the violence that we see around us, and people not having good boundaries, or, you know, doing hurtful things to others, or the, you know, not keeping their promise and so on, and neglect. And they had a database of like 17,000 Kaiser Permanente patients, you know, who were mostly white, middle class, college educated, working, you know, insured people. And they had this amazing matrix of few have more than 3 of these things. And that's not an exhaustive list. And it's been since expanded to deal with all kinds of, you know, traumas related to racism, related to poverty, related to immigration, related to, you know, political violence, all kinds of things. But they came up with this correlation that, you know, at some point there's a high correlation that people are going to have anxiety or depression, or people are going to have COPD, or people are going to have asthma, or people are going to have heart attacks, or people are going to end up with different kinds of addictions. They'll be smokers, they'll be, you know, drug users. And it's not causation, but the point is, and there have been many books that are, and studies and teachings about this now, you know, physicians, Bruce Perry is one, Van der Kalk in Holland is one, Gabor Mate in Canada is one. And I mean, it's Peter Levine. I mean, all these people who are saying that the body absorbs these unresolved traumas that give us, you know, these interpretations about ourselves and the world, and those things just run in our background, and they may keep us kind of hyper alert, and that has a physical impact on us as well. As it, you know, may lead people to cope in different ways, to avoid things or to do things like, you know, if my system is in the fight flight mode and stirred up a lot, then it's going to be harder to sleep. So maybe I take sleeping pills, or maybe I drink, or maybe I smoke. And then that kind of snowballs. And so it's just the science behind, you know, the understanding that we were too often dealing with, you know, the question of what's wrong with you, you know, why are you doing this behavior, and pathologizing the behavior, right? You know,
so
the drug is the problem.
Is this a test that somebody would take themselves? Would they ask their therapist maybe? If they could go through those questions with them, is it something that they do over time, or if it's something you just like the MMPI where you just sit down and answer 300 questions, or
yeah, I mean,
kind of all the being
I'm sure used. It's online.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's okay. Always, I think, helpful to have the information itself, and then to be able to explore maybe with someone, you know, like, oh, this makes sense that. Mm-hmm. Certain, you know, things continue to be recurring, you know, behaviors,
yeah,
or, you know, problems and so on.
Yeah.
Felitti, I mean, what he was hoping was that and when people are going to have a doctor's appointment, that they fill out the questionnaire and the doctor could say, and they actually did this at some point. You say, oh, I see you have so many of these ACEs. Well, you know, just to let you know, it makes sense that you might have certain, you know, health conditions, because, but to let you know, you know, that we're going to work with you. And just to acknowledge has a powerful impact that people aren't, you know, been continuing to think of themselves as like, I'm messed up. But, okay, it makes sense. There's a connection between my life experiences that and what my current, you know, physical behavioral health. And
I was locked up in a state mental hospital, and you know, I was really messed up, and I was just happy with staying there, you know, because like everything was just so much easier. But I was married at the time, and my husband kept coming and bringing my kids on the weekends, and you know, I knew my kids were okay and everything, and so I was, you know, I was okay. And I got a weekend pass, and I went to see my grandmother, and I just had this compelling feeling, because what was happening, I was crawling around on my hands and my knees, and I'd end up in the corner, and I'd be whimpering and just holding on to myself and whimpering and shaking. And I'd come out of it, and I didn't even know I was doing it. I don't even know how long I did this for, because my husband one time noticed me doing it, and we didn't know what the heck was going on, you know, because I couldn't remember what had happened at all. And so, you know, I was suicidal, and so I ended up in the state hospital. Well, I went back to my grandparents because I came to live with them. My mom put me on a train on my first birthday with my two brothers and sent us to Minnesota. And I found out later on, she said, I sent you away because I knew you were in danger. She said, I just felt you were. I didn't have no, you know, reason to think that way. I just felt that way, which it was a good reason. She did good thing she did. And I told her that before she died, because she always called herself a bad mom, you know. Mm. But anyway, I went back to my grandmother, and I told her what was going on. And I said, was I like that when I first came to live with you? She said, yeah. I said, well, didn't you think that was weird? Mm. Yeah. I said, well, did you take me to the doctor or anything? Yeah, we took you to the doctor. Well, it's like pulling teeth, you know. Well, what did the doctor say? Well, the doctor said we should never tell you. And I go, tell me what? I cannot tell you. And I said, why won't you tell me? She said, because the doctor said, if we don't tell you, it won't affect you. And I said, obviously, it's affecting me. She said, I was acting like that when I came to live with her. I said, obviously, it's affecting me. I'm locked up in a state mental hospital, which I probably will never get out of. At least if I know what happened, maybe I can get help. And she finally told me that the doctor examined me, said my vaginal opening was way too big for a child that age. Mm. And of course, didn't use the word sexually abused, you know. But once I started, you know, I had all kinds of female problems all along. Once I finally found a lot of this stuff out and more memories started coming back, and I'm working on the MPD, more memories come back, I went to my gynecologist, and I told him that I was a victim of sexual abuse and incest. Mm-hmm. And he said, I figured that was what was going on, because I would freak out when he would do the exam, you know, and I would talk myself through it. I would begin to calm down by talking myself through it, you know. But he just came out and said, instead of saying, like what you're talking about, asking those hard questions, they never used to do
just
that.
Just acknowledging.
They might know in their mind something happened, but they didn't ask you, and they didn't say, this is a response to that, you know.
Yeah. I'm mindful that we probably don't have a lot of time. But what a powerful example of how, you know, secrets, and I think it's a common phrase, you know, we're as sick as our secrets, and, you know, how badly people have, who with medical or religious or other kind of authority, have just avoided acknowledging something that, by acknowledging it, then we can actually deal with it, right? And I think that's in the being able to tell our story, being able to, you know, the doctor and others don't have to do anything, but just to acknowledge is a starting point, you know. And then those who have some skills and who are safe, they can be resources for the actual, you know, healing process. But I just thank you for this conversation. There's an awesome letter, you could Google, it's called Dear Doctor, and it was a story in Kaiser Permanente Journal many, many years ago. And I met the person, it wasn't named, but I met the author years ago. And it's a perfect example of how, you know, doctors were missing all kinds of signs of trauma and abuse.
Yeah.
But
Well, I ended up friending you on Facebook, and also I'm the Minnesota ambassador for NASCA. And, I'd like to continue this conversation. There's a lot more that I do as well for education and empowering people too. I've been doing this, for quite a while now, but only because of the help of others and people that are speaking out and helping us like you are and telling your story. I really, really appreciate it. And I think we're going to be playing the music here in just a few seconds, I hope.
Yeah.
Annie, you're on. Thanks, Annie.
Good night, everyone.
Good night now.
Thank you.
Tomorrow, 'cause that dawn was-